This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Israel struck hard today. After a rash of hideous suicide bombings that killed 25 civilians over the weekend, the Israeli military pointed the finger at Yasser Arafat and fired missiles at Arafat's personal helicopters on the ground in Gaza City. The United States has given tacit support to the Israeli retaliation. Prime Minister Sharon, in his speech today, echoed the very language of America's war on terror. How long can this go on, and what can possibly end it? First, we check in with Christian Science Monitor reporter Ben Linfield in Jerusalem earlier today. He's been covering recent developments in Israel and the Palestinian-controlled territories. We asked him about the extent of the Israeli military response today.
There were two aspects to the military response. One was helicopter gunship and rocket attacks in Gaza City on Yasser Arafat's compound there. These attacks took out two helicopters, which are used by Arafat mostly to get between Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And they also hit an underground fuel depot, which caused the big fire, and the smoke could be seen throughout Gaza City. The other military activity was Israeli use of F-16s to bomb a Palestinian Authority police station in the West Bank town of Jenin. It's significant that they used the F-16s. That's the first time that's happened in months.
Do the helicopter attacks appear to have been a threat to Arafat personally, to his person?
No, Arafat was in the West Bank at the time, so there was no element of threatening him personally.
But even at the messaging level, Ben?
Well, the message to him is that he has very stern military action coming up unless he does what Israel defines as steps that are necessary to crack down on Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Of course, Arafat would argue that he already began that crackdown and that his security forces arrested more than 100 activists.
In his speech to the nation today, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon took a very hard line against Yasser Arafat and the PLO and seemed to draw the same kind of equation that George Bush has drawn with terrorism and a response that may amount to something very significant militarily?
Well, yes, that was quite deliberate and explicit, the allusion to the United States, what is termed in the United States the war on terrorism. Actually, Sharon went so far as to say we have to follow the example of President Bush. He also very significantly spoke about the Israeli army, this time using additional means against targets that Israel defines as terrorists. Now, what has to be noted is that Sharon is now convinced that he has broad international backing for taking very stern military steps against the Palestinian Authority, and indeed, as you know, the Bush administration retroactively endorsed the Israeli raids on Gaza, saying, with Bush's spokesman Ari Fleischer saying, Israel has the right to defend itself. So Sharon is completely convinced. I would say he believes he has, if not a green light, something very close to it to move against the Palestinian Authority.
But Ben Linfield, what might that mean? If Israel significantly stepped up the military response, what does it mean? Invading the entire West Bank, taking back all the territory? There's already a strong Israeli presence in the area.
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, you've hit on the dilemma for the Israeli political and military planners. The far-right people in the Sharon cabinet are calling for exactly the steps you outlined, taking over all of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That situation would probably create more problems for Israel than it would solve, and it would also go against a lot of the public opinion in the country. However, there are steps short of that. If you recall, a few weeks ago, Israel went in and took over six cities in the West Bank. So Sharon does have some options, but I think the option of a complete takeover of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is one even he would feel the disadvantages would outweigh the advantages.
And what would be the point of these interim steps of taking over more cities or moving into the Gaza Strip? What would it accomplish exactly?
Well, you know, in order to answer that, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that Ariel Sharon wants to accomplish? In my reading of Ariel Sharon, his long-term objective is to have Israel control most of the West Bank, for all of the Jewish settlements there to remain intact and to expand them, to have a very weak Palestinian entity or very limited autonomy situation there. And all of this entails not having diplomatic activity along the lines that Anthony Zinni, the U.S. mediator, is trying to push right now, because this implies, to have true diplomatic activity implies a freeze on the Jewish settlements. That is something Ariel Sharon does not want to do. In my reading, he wants to bring to bear Israel's military force in a way that will serve his long-term objective of annexing settlements and territories to Israel and precluding the possibility of there being a viable and territorially contiguous Palestinian state. But I would like to stress that the official line of the Israeli government is to accept the Tenet ceasefire arrangements and to accept the Mitchell report, which ends up with diplomacy and the settlement freeze. But in fact, every time a ceasefire has been attempted, Israel has continued assassinating Palestinian fugitives, wanted militants, people who've carried out attacks, and that has inflamed the Palestinian streets. Now Israel is faced with a genuine terrorist threat, but the question is, will Ariel Sharon exploit that to go beyond an immediate retaliation and try to set and impose a long-term solution on the West Bank and Gaza Strip?
What was the response today to events from Yasser Arafat and the PLO?
Basically, the Palestinian Authority has been trying to give the impression, which is completely necessary for it to give, now that the Bush administration has come down and made very clear demands on Arafat, that they're actually taking decisive action against Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Whether that is actually the case is very difficult to tell at this point.
Have funerals begun today for any of the 25 Israelis who were killed over the weekend?
Yes, there were more funerals, and the important thing to stress about the funerals is that Israel is a very, very tightly knit society. Every death is felt, and when these funerals are held, the first thing you will see on news broadcasts is footage of the funerals and also sort of encapsulated life stories of the people who were killed. And it accentuates the public's feeling of and trauma that they are really facing a tidal wave of terrorist attacks.
Ben Linfield is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. Can Yasser Arafat get a handle on Palestinian terrorism? Did Israel respond too soon with retaliatory attacks? And how much now depends on the actions of the international community? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis. Good evening, Anthony Lewis.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Anthony Lewis.
Hello, Jack.
Anthony Lewis, you've written a lot and recently about the situation in Israel. Today, the word war is being used up, down, and sideways. What would war mean in these tight little sad quarters and that we haven't seen already, and what could it achieve?
I thought your question to Mr. Linfield and his answer were really the gist of the matter, both extremely good. What would it accomplish exactly, you asked him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, Sharon really doesn't want serious substantive negotiations of the kind that would require the Mitchell program to begin with a freeze on settlements. He simply wants to preclude a viable Palestinian state and do that unilaterally. And I suppose that anything he does will point toward that. And I will tell you my opinion. I think that is a recipe for disaster for Israel, absolute disaster, to go on trying to confine the Palestinians, storing up more anger and more potential terrorism.
But the kind of attacks we saw over this weekend also seemed tailor-made to preclude any peaceful progress toward the Palestinian state that Washington's been talking about recently.
Absolutely. I think the two sides, the terrorists among the Palestinians on the one side and the Sharon government on the other, both rely on force and violence and They are equally fruitless, in my opinion, because, you know, if you look at it from the Palestinian side, what you've just said is obviously true. Those acts of terrorism, bloody, horrible, disastrous terrorism, not only kill a lot of innocent people, but they destroy the Palestinian case. And on the other side, you know, Sharon had, as you pointed out in your conversation with Mr. Linfield, he's had the army surrounding six or seven Palestinian cities, and they were there for weeks, and they supposedly got rid of all the terrorists. And, you know, the next week or two, bang, we have the most awful acts of terrorism in a very long time. So that doesn't work either.
So here we are. It seems an impossible situation getting more impossible. It was only a month ago that you wrote in one of your columns, Anthony Lewis, that the only solution, and a solution that even Israelis and Palestinians were beginning to speak up for, would be some kind of solution imposed by the international community, which you said meant imposed by the United States. Can you imagine that actually being possible here, and what would it be?
My honest answer is I can't imagine the Bush administration doing it, because that's not its way of proceeding. And in fact, it would be very hard, honestly, for any American government to do that, very risky and difficult. But, you know, there are a lot of people on both sides, right across the political spectrum, who would breathe a sigh of relief if the United States said, okay, you guys, you've killed enough of each other, this is what we're doing. A lot of people there, for all their fierceness, for all their bloodiness and the awful things they do, would welcome it. That's my opinion.
And what could that...
And I talked to a lot of people when I was there last month, as you say.
Mm-hmm. We saw it. But what would that solution possibly look like if the Bush administration had the stomach or the inclination to do it, which, as you say, they in all likelihood do not. But if they did, what could it possibly look like that could be enforced and leave everyone with a sense that they may not like it, but it was tolerable?
Oh, that's very obvious. The only solution that would fit that description is the one that was almost reached at Camp David and at Taba in the waning days of the Clinton administration. It's a solution that left almost all the West Bank in the hands of the Palestinians, a discrete number of Israeli settlements remaining close to Israel proper, and with a small part of Jerusalem where the majority population is Palestinian under Palestinian control. That's a solution. There's no other solution. That's the only one that really is on offer.
And yet, Jack Beatty, we're not reaching for this solution. At least the parties are not reaching for this solution. And the stakes for everyone, including the United States now, with our military on the ground in the Middle East, are very high.
They are very high, and they're made higher by the parallel that Mr. Sharon draws to our war on terror. The starkest statement I've seen out of Israel today was from the UN envoy there, Turgay Larson, who said, "Either a civil war among the Palestinians or a war between Israel and Palestine within the next 12 hours, there is no alternative." Well, if there is that civil war, that, after all, has been the longtime strategy of bin Ladenism, of Islamic extremism, to have civil wars between the secular regimes, the Palestinian authority being a sort of rudimentary one, and the terrorists and the Islamists. And that would be a dreadful undertaking. And a war between Israel and Palestine, which would sort of amalgamate the enemies, or, you know, drive the Palestinian Authority forces in with the terrorists, that would be even worse. So if those are the alternatives, then there's an abyss just, he says, within the next 12 hours.
Anthony,
there was one little filament, though, of hope in the Jerusalem Post, and that was that the Palestinian Authority asked Israel to stay its hand for 4 days before it responded to the terror attacks, and that they made this offer to the foreign minister, Peres. He wanted to go along with it, but Sharon did not and overruled him. Now, if the attacks on today were just symbolic messages to Arafat rather than the full panoply of the military response, maybe something can be salvaged from that. And in those 4 days, the Palestinian Authority can show that it means business.
Jack Beatty, Anthony Lewis with the New York Times, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about the impossible situation in Israel. Where, oh, where is the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis? Is it time for war? And what would war mean in this tiny land? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the surge of violence in Israel. Here's Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon speaking earlier today, tying his response to the Palestinian terrorist attacks to the United States' reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks.
As has been done in the world under the courageous leadership of President Bush, who acting forcefully against terrorism, so we will act with all our force, with all our determination, with all our means that we have used to date, and also using new means that are available to us.
Where is the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis? We need it. Things are looking grimmer than ever. We're joined this evening by Anthony Lewis, a columnist with the New York Times, our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. We're also joined now by Jonathan Wilson. He's a novelist, a journalist. He spent years living in Israel, chair of the English department at Tufts University. Good evening, Jonathan Wilson.
Evening, Tom.
You've spent a lot of time in Israel, and you're in close touch with many people there. You just heard Anthony Lewis saying the only way to get to a peace is to have the Palestinians have the West Bank, the Israelis essentially have Israel, bring the settlements back close to the border. It seems obvious in one sense. Why doesn't it happen?
I think it doesn't happen when the governing bodies on both sides allow the extremists to dictate policy. And essentially, I think what we're seeing now is, with the recent bombings, on the Israeli side, the bombers produce, in a way, the situation that proves their vision correct. In other words, if you can, and the same is true from the other side as well.
So, Anthony Lewis, if that's the case, how do we possibly get out of the grips of people who have the most extreme agendas in this conflict?
I thought that was well put. The governing bodies let extremists dictate policy on both sides. I wish I had an answer to your question, Mr. Ashbrook. I don't. The only answer is the way that Senator Mitchell proposed, is begin negotiating, and not with any this artificial notion that we have to have no attacks of any kind for 7 days. That means no Palestinian attacks, because, as Mr. Linfield pointed out, the Israeli attacks continued.
That's been Ariel Sharon's condition.
But that hasn't happened, and I think the only way to do it is to get to negotiations right away. But, you know, that will take enormous leadership by the United States, which hasn't been forthcoming.
Do you have the feeling that Washington now recognizes that the stakes have changed, they've grown, that our overall interest in the Middle East is now more keen and acute, that in fact the U.S. may get more involved?
Yes, they recognize it, but their answer today, maybe it was an unavoidable answer to Sharon, in effect, do what you want to, is not the sort of thing that's going to allow the United States to make any progress. That's not going to solve the problem. So whether we're willing to be courageous enough to say you two people have to get together, and we're going to have negotiations starting Wednesday. The two of you come here. It's the only way we're going to get this thing started, begin ending the violence. Let's talk. And the United States could at least do that. Let's talk beginning tomorrow, beginning Wednesday, whenever it is. Whether we have the guts to do that, I don't know.
And is there any leverage left up our sleeve that we've not used in the past? Surely we've trotted out every ounce of leverage we have.
Well, leverage. We haven't used any leverage to speak of against Israel, against the Sharon government. That is difficult to do. But if you have a government determined to do it, we use it. It was used last most signally by George W. Bush's father, who used leverage to make Israel stop building settlements for a very brief time, only briefly, but then he stopped being president.
Anthony Lewis, stand by. Jonathan Wilson, we have a pile of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's open the lines. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What should the United States do in the interest of peace in the Middle East? What can it do? Alone is on the line. Welcome, Alone. You're on the air.
Well, yes, thank you very much. The comment that I wanted to make was, I think it's entirely disingenuous to apportion equal blame for the current situation between Israel and the Palestinians. I think we all remember that last July, Israel made what I think was potentially terribly painful concessions in essentially giving all of the Gaza, in offering to give all of the Gaza Strip, almost the entire West Bank, and a major portion of the Old City, as well as Temple Mount. This offer by Barak and the Israelis was basically responded to with violence, which has continued for the past 14 months. There's really nothing more that Israel can give than what they had offered. And I think, you know, again, to state that, you know, one side is being obstinate and the other side is being obstinate is absolutely incorrect. That's not what happened over the past year.
Alon, please stand by. Let me put that to Anthony Lewis. Anthony Lewis, the caller says it's wrong to divvy up blame equally here. Is that your point, or does it?
I share the view that it was tragic that Arafat responded as he did. The offer by Israel was not quite as straightforward as the caller suggested, but I agree that it was tragic for Arafat simply to dismiss it out of hand. Really awful. But it's also, I think, misleading to say you can't apportion the blame equally. Since the Oslo agreement supposedly put the two parties on track to peace, Israel has doubled the number of settlers in the West Bank. There have been innumerable Israeli attacks of all kinds, and not just on targets, military targets. Lots of children and others have been killed, and we all know that. Not purposely, but that's inevitably what has happened. So you can understand the feeling of Palestinians that their country, their land, their potential state is just being continuously taken away from them. And there's a lot of blame to be apportioned on Israel on that account.
Anthony Lewis, those settlements you refer to are often described as using unused portions of the West Bank for Israel to expand and make homes. You were in Ramallah recently. That's not the way you saw it.
No, of course not. Unused. Well, I suppose if some other country came in and moved into the outskirts of Boston and said, well, here's an unused piece of land, let's take it, we wouldn't think that was very nice. All land is used for one purpose or another. You knock down all the olive trees and build apartments. The person who was growing olives there doesn't think it was unused. But in fact, in Ramallah, which you mentioned, the Israeli settlements are not settlements in the way that we romantically think of them, perhaps, as sort of outposts, but they're apartment houses right up against the city of Ramallah, part right just next to everybody else's house and under guard. And it's, you know, it hems in the city, and it's another country taking over part of yours. That's the way it feels to the Palestinians.
Jonathan Wilson, you've been and spoken with many Israelis there. Does Israel have it in itself to give up these settlements, or is that just not going to happen?
Well, I think it absolutely does, and I think the settlements are sometimes blown up into something much larger than they are, in the sense that, I mean, not from the Palestinian point of view, but in the sense that a friend I was speaking to in Jerusalem today told me that there was a poll on Channel 1 Israeli TV in the middle of this second intifada, and the vote was overwhelmingly, you know, sort of, would you give up the settlements in favor of real peace? Mm-hmm. And I think that most Israelis would, as most Israelis clearly were going to when they voted in Barak. So I don't think the settlements are really the sticking point.
Jack Beatty, do you think then that the United States is asking the right things from each party here?
I really don't know. You know, the assumption, though, is that land will lead to peace, that swapping land will lead to peace. And we had an Arab intellectual on this program a couple of weeks ago who said that the metric may well be shifting from the debate over land to a debate between Islamic extremists and Israelis about the existence of Israel. And that's what seems to me so tragic, that so long as the political debate between Palestinian nationalism and Israel is unsettled, so long as the Land for Peace deal doesn't happen. That just gives the suicide bombers and that whole culture of suicide bombing and Islamic fundamentalism time to gather momentum. I mean, they're not only do the suicide bombers now get the usual blandishments of heaven, but apparently Hamas pays a kind of annuity to their families and buys them new furniture. They're subsidized. This is the thing that may well just make these questions about land for peace seem rational next to this cauldron of implacable hatred that seems to be building in the hearts of these suicide bombers.
Anthony Lewis, I know we have to lose you in a moment. I want to get your last thoughts here. The stakes seem so enormously high beyond what we're normally confronted with now. The whole region is a war footing on two sides now. Where do your thoughts go tonight?
My thoughts are just overwhelmingly depressed, Mr. Ashbrook, I have to tell you. I don't have a simple solution. I've been an optimist on most things all my life, on the most difficult, intractable conflicts in South Africa, in Ireland, and in the Middle East. Those were the three that mostly have concerned me. Two of them have been settled or nearly settled, and the one in Israel is, as Jack Beatty just said, getting worse and worse and more emotional and less rational. And I don't honestly know how that's going to stop the way things are now. It's just really awful.
One larger question for you. I don't know if you've given any thought to this, but of course there's a school of thought in Washington that wants to take the war on terrorism to Iraq. Is that checkmated while things are so tenuous and so violent in Israel and the Palestinian area?
It certainly makes it much more difficult because already not only are European allies are very nervous and about going on to Iraq and really opposed, but the Arab world would find it, despite their dislike, most Arab governments for Saddam Hussein, they would find it very hard to take. But to have that happen while essentially the Palestinian Authority is being crushed and the hope of an independent Palestine is disappearing, for whatever reason, even though it may have been caused by these dreadful suicide bombers, for whatever reason, to have that happen at that time would be quite intolerable to them, I think. Your point is a good one.
Anthony Lewis, we thank you for your clarity and your candor. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Anthony Lewis, columnist with The New York Times. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We have a long line of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's turn there. Ray is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Ray, welcome.
Yes. My question concerns, why doesn't a multinational force go in and create a Palestinian state instead of all this diplomatic talk seems to not be getting anywhere?
So a kind of UN force, the same kind of thing we're talking about in Afghanistan or elsewhere?
Yeah, because the extremists in the Israeli government will never allow, never going to allow this to happen. I think the world has to step in and create this country and draw a line and take steps that British back in 48 wouldn't do, Britain.
Ray, thanks for your call. Jonathan Wilson, you've written in your role as a novelist in your book, The Hiding Room, about exactly that period of what is now Israel during World War II and the British role then. What lessons can we take from that about the possibility of a world power, Britain then, the United States now, imposing something on the region that doesn't occur there organically?
Well, I think there's always, it's certainly a powerful dream that a sort of deus ex machina could come in and make everything okay. And I certainly think a lot of Israelis or people on both sides probably have that dream at the moment. I don't know. History has shown that it tends to be more of an illusion than a dream that can be realized. But certainly, clearly, the only country that can do that now is the United States. It didn't work with the British for a number of reasons. It certainly has never worked with the UN, when a UN has come in between two countries in the Middle East. But I think, there's at least some hope it could happen with America. Whether I don't think it's something the Israeli government or the Israeli military want, but maybe.
And probably not the Bush administration either. But Jack Beatty, it is interesting. You hear this flitting around the edges of the conversation these days because people are so desperate for a solution, some kind of multinational force that would bring a settlement that would give security to both sides. Can you imagine it?
Well, over the summer, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times was thinking aloud about, and he was quoting other people, about the possibility, basically saying that these parties can't reach peace themselves, and that the best solution is to separate these peoples and to separate them literally with a wall. And I think he was even talking about NATO as, you know, policing that wall as a kind of permanent guarantor of peace. Now, in an interview today, Prime Minister Sharon said, no, walls leak. Mm. But I don't know. I mean, that sounds like an awfully mechanical solution. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if the alternative is a kind of region-wide war, that is to say the Islamist extremists starting a civil war with the Palestinian Authority, or the Israel tipping the Palestinian Authority into their arms, and this run going on with the kind of violence guerrilla warfare can bring, mm-hmm. and that in turn sparking a kind of pan-Arab response, you could have a kind of repeat of the wars of the 60s and 70s. Mm. And so maybe in that respect, the wall, a separation of these peoples, drastic as it is, I don't know. It sounds like a better alternative than that, at least.
With everything that's going on, presumptions of what's possible and impossible just may be changing. Barry is on the line. Welcome, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I have a comment. I'm feeling that it's sort of fashionable to criticize Israel over Palestine. It seems like most people that talk about it, most of these analysts are kind of biased in that way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've had a taste now of what it's like to live under the constant threat of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And in Israel, it's even more real than it is here. And so for us to think that it's okay for the United States to go after terrorists, but it's not okay for Israel to do it and protect its citizens, I mean, they are living under it every single day.
No.
I heard a program on your very station about mm-hmm. how people leave home and they don't know if they will live to see that night. Mm. And I also heard an interview today that Arafat doesn't really want a solution because if he ended up with a country, he doesn't know for sure if he'd be able to lead it and he might be out.
Barry, we've learned ourselves this fall what it's like a little bit to live with that kind of pressure. We thank you for your perspective and your call. Jonathan Wilson, you've been in touch with people in Israel who feel this very fear of simply going for a cup of coffee.
Yes. I think, first, there is an acute sense of being alone in Israel. There is something that we could all identify with, which is simply, anxiety about your children getting on a bus, yourself getting on a bus. More and more people drive everywhere, tell their children not to go into crowded places, mm-hmm. and so on. And I think that there's also a great depression because of a sense that I think Jack alluded to earlier, that you're taking on with the suicide bombers a kind of culture of death which you cannot understand at all. That this is not a sense anymore that that Israelis are being attacked over land, but simply because somebody wants them dead.
That describes a very difficult situation. Barry, thanks for your call. We'll come back after a short break. We're talking about the crisis, and it is ratcheted up as high as ever right now in Israel. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or join the conversation online at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Israel. The suicide bombing attacks over the weekend were the worst coordinated attacks in a long, long time. The worst, perhaps, in 14 months of intifada. It seems to be reaching a point that it just can't go on. And today, both sides are using the word war, Ariel Sharon and Palestinian spokesman. What would war mean today in this tiny, sad corner of the world? And what can be done to prevent it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour by Jonathan Wilson, novelist, journalist, chair of the English department at Tufts University, author of The Hiding Room, and now by Steve Cohen. He's a visiting professor at Princeton University and president of the Institute for Middle East Peace and Development. Good evening, Steve Cohen. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
Steve Cohen, there's an extra urgency around all these conversations these days because there is another war going on. U.S. troops are on the ground and Afghans are it's a hot war. The fighting is there. And there's it all seems to raise the stakes very high. There's been talk about that war going on into Iraq, and suddenly we see here the possibility of an arc right across the region. How do you think this tension and now ratcheted up violence in Israel plays into that in geopolitical terms? How does it change the way people, the international community, looks at this crisis in Israel itself?
Yes, and I think it changes very much the prognosis for this crisis. Because this is not Israeli-Palestinian violence operating only between Israelis and Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
This is Israeli-Palestinian violence in the context of an international crisis in which the United States is at war against terrorism,
mm-hmm.
in which the United States has put together a coalition which depends on not only its own military capability, but on the acquiescence of Europeans and Russians and the United Nations and Egypt and Jordan and other countries. And therefore, I think that this act of terrorism by the Palestinians and the Israeli response to that act of terrorism is going to be seen in an international context, not only in its local context.
What difference is that going to make, and how will we see the difference?
Well, I think we're going to see the difference very significantly, and I think we've already seen it today.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Prime Minister went to great lengths in his speech to compare what he's doing to what the United States is doing,
mm-hmm.
and he very pointedly attacked a base of operations for President Arafat when he was in a completely different base of operations.
But that would seem to suggest that what we're going to see is an even higher level of violence, not restraint or not imposed restraint.
Well, but I'm saying to you that mm-hmm. he didn't attack him where he was.
Mm-hmm.
He attacked him where he wasn't. It was more of a symbolic attack than a real attack.
But isn't that a shot across the bow that says, hey, it could be you next time?
But why a shot across the bow? And that's the question. The question is whether or not both Arafat and Sharon are operating in this situation with an awareness of the enormous consequences of what they're doing for the American war in the region. There's no question that Arafat realizes that he tried desperately to avoid the mistakes he made in the American war against Iraq and Kuwait,
mm-hmm.
which was such a disaster for him when with the Iraqis.
But Sharon is saying today it's Arafat's fault. He's very explicit about that. And using the Bush parallel, that would seem to suggest if it's his fault, we can go after him. If that would be the next step, if Arafat is somehow removed from power, what would that mean?
Well, I think that the United States is already trying to make a distinction between what has to be done to Arafat and what has to be done to the terrorists. I think that there is a possibility, of course, that Israel will change its policy from bombing Arafat where he isn't to trying to drive him out. But I think it's more of a warning to him that his moment of acceptability in the international community, including with the United States,
mm-hmm.
is very limited now, and that if he responds appropriately, he is going to get the chance to remain there, and if he doesn't respond appropriately, then other things are going to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the key now is whether the United States is able to successfully make the distinction that it has wanted to make between Hamas and Islamic Jihad on the one hand
mm-hmm.
as terrorist groups in the style of the terrorist groups that the United States is fighting its war against,
Al-Qaeda, et cetera,
versus Arafat, who represents another example of a failing state
almost state, like other problematic states that the United States is trying to prop up and trying to redesign by its efforts. In other words, what is the battle here? Is the Palestinian entity like Afghanistan once Hamas and Islamic Jihad are wiped out? And is the United States going to be making a commitment to help construct that entity once Islamic Jihad and Hamas are out of the picture?
What giant imponderables here. I want to get one more call in before the end of our hour. It's almost coming to a close, at least this discussion. Harvey's on the line. Hello, Harvey.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
Hi. Well, I guess part of what amazes me in the conversation and in what I just heard is sort of the assumption that all things being equal, Sharon would welcome Arafat as a partner. I mean, that seems ridiculous historically. The Likud, Netanyahu, Sharon have always acted as if there are only terrorists on the other side. And in some ways, it's come true. That seems to be the case. But it's not as if we have Israeli leaders right now who are willing to make peace and who are willing to make the concessions of land for peace necessary. And I think my assumption is actually if Hamas quit it, the same sort of people that killed Yitzhak Rabin would again pick up the gun.
Harvey, our time is running down, I think. I thank you for your call. Our time's running down. Jonathan Wilson, what about that? Do you see any sign? We've just got 30 seconds here. But this government will embrace any entity from that
side.
Well,
I think that there's a long tradition of right-wing leaders embracing peace when the time seems to be right. I think what's much scarier is that we seem to be passing beyond a sort of history that we can understand when we're dealing with Islamic fundamentalism, suicide bombers, that there's a kind of irrational madness that all of our rational discussion does not seem able to encompass.
Jonathan Wilson, thank you. Thank you for being with us tonight. Jonathan Wilson is chair of the English department at Tufts University, author of The Hiding Room and the forthcoming book, A Palestine Affair. And thank you, Steve Cohen, for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Steve Cohen is a visiting professor at Princeton University and president of the Institute for Middle East Peace and Development. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Yesterday, just hours after a third suicide bomber struck on the streets of Israel, several hundred New Yorkers gathered in Midtown Manhattan, part call to prayer, part call to action. The speakers mourned the dead, offered support for the policies of Israel, condemned Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, and called on the United States to support Israel's battle against terrorism. Here are some sounds from the rally that took place Sunday afternoon in Manhattan.
America has its Osama bin Laden, and Israel has its Osama bin Laden. They're all the same. They must all be captured, dead or alive.
Terrorists killed thousands of Americans. They killed thousands of dreams. They tried to make America afraid. The terrorists tried to make Israel afraid. Innocent people were murdered in America, just as they are murdered in Israel. Not because they are caught in the crossfire of war, but because terrorists aim at them in the crosshairs of their guns.
My sister Lisa was 20 years old when a suicide bomber murdered her while she was studying in Israel. At the end of this month, I will celebrate my 20th birthday. As the years go by, I will celebrate more birthdays, but my older sister will always be 20.
We know that fear distorts. Fear prevents us from seeing reality. Fear does not enable us to respond properly and answer the question of how. And as much as we feel grief today, we must ask ourselves, how do we respond?
We have to make sure that there are positives that come out of the tragedies and sacrifices of the last day and the last year.
Psalm of David, Lord is my shepherd, I shall not lack.
Sarah Lowski, Israel.
W. Wahid, USA.
Kobe Mandel, Israel.
David Lowski, USA.
We will not be paralyzed by fear. We will stand with our government. We will stand with Israel in the mutual war against terrorism. And we will win.
To all who seek true peace, Al tira mi pachad pitom, fear not the sudden terror, Umishoat rasha'im ki tavo, or the holocaust of the wicked that may come.
We mourn the senseless bloodshed, massive killings by those who would seek as their ultimate goal to destroy the state of Israel. There are Christians who stand with you today in sorrow and in support of Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East.
Like the IDF, the American Armed Forces have forged partnerships with militiamen who are no Boy Scouts. Still, they've done the right thing. Like his Israeli counterpart, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has targeted cold-blooded murderers, putting a price tag on Osama bin Laden's head. And he's done the right thing. And most recently, he's warned Saddam Hussein that if necessary, he's ready to preemptively finish the work Israel began 20 years ago at Osirak. Finally, we're doing the right thing.
Sounds from a rally that took place yesterday in Manhattan in support of Israel and the United States' war on terror. Jack Beatty, quite an hour of opinions and views there. And out of all of it, we see out of the attacks this weekend and Ariel Sharon's speech today, this new tight equation between the U.S. war on terrorism and Israel's conflict with the Palestinians.
Yeah, but there is a salient difference, and that was one, I think, brought out by Secretary Powell yesterday. He did say, we're not about to tell Sharon what to do, as the headlines have emphasized. But he also said this, we've always said to both sides, you better think about the consequences of what happens the next day or the day after. He's referring there to the cycle of violence. And those people in New York understandably want to strike out at these fiends who did this. But, of course, the pattern is that this will not bring peace, that there is no military solution possible there because these fish, the guerrillas, are so deeply embedded into this sea of hatred of Israel, there'll be no getting them out. Therefore, there's only a political solution. And that, I think, is different from what we're facing. Perhaps there is some kind of military solution that with what we're dealing with. That is to say, an extirpation of Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan and a ripping out of its cells, so far as we can find them, around the world. Let's hope there's a military solution, because that's the only solution that we're pursuing here.
Well, that's really the question, isn't it? If there's not, then the one's fear is that Israel and the Palestinians conflict becomes the model for this whole larger global conflict that President Bush has described. And given the endlessness of the Israelis' struggle there, that's a very, very disturbing prospect.
It is, and at least for Americans, we don't share. We don't have to live, you know, side by side with people who want to kill us, or at least in almost equivalent populations. The Israeli solution is unique in that respect. But yeah, I mean, is this? Of course, it could also be the things have changed there, right, and quickly. Chairman Arafat is a tragically indecisive leader. Just a couple of weeks ago, he had a big blowout with his own people who said, you've got to crack down. And his answer was to exile the people who argued against him. Maybe now he'll act.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
You can listen to Ariel Sharon's speech or read a transcript of it on our website. Go to WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR. We're